in France.
So thank you very much. It's an honor to be here. 6 years ago, I came for the World Science Forum, actually because I was receiving a European Young Investigator Award in Budapest. And I discovered a very beautiful program that is exactly about what you were saying. Young people, teenagers, are doing science. And I was so amazed by what they were doing, because this was the exact moment when French suburbs were burning because the French teenagers were rioting. Okay. So we then started this new program, and I got since then very engaged in scientific education ever more. Okay. So today I want to talk about the changing landscape of learning through research. It used to be that learning through research was reserved to an elite in a few hyper-selected universities, but things are changing, and that's what I would like to talk about today. So what you can see on the left is clearly, you know, the first man on the moon, and the computers that allow him to go on the moon. Okay. Today, in a cell phone, in any cell phone, even, you know, the cheapest cell phone in Africa, you have more computing power than the NASA used to go to the moon. Okay. So that's how much the landscape is changing. Okay. And you can also transform this cell phone into scientific instruments, because here this is a picture where you can add a microscope. You can just add a lens and you transform your cell phone into a microscope. Okay? Actually, the challenge I give to my student today is, given what I've just said, is to tell them, you know, imagine whoever is your favorite scientist of the past, try to imagine what that scientist could have done with a cell phone, where there is so much scientific power and technology and computing that, you know, you can really have, in fact, a mobile laboratory in your pocket. So you don't have to spend, you know, billions on rockets to go to the moon. Today you can, you know, go to new moons to be conquered thanks to this new technology that is available to everyone. And that's what is being discussed in this book called Reinventing Discovery. So that's, you know, part of the landscape. Another part of the landscape is this left graph, where you have an exponential growth of the number of scientific publications since the 18th century. Okay, so today there is 1 million-fold more journals to read than 300 years ago. Okay, so when I was educated, by 1905 physics. Okay, and today there is 100-fold more physics, and, you know, even more in other disciplines such as biology. And today there is even robots that do science. Okay, so basically, the question is, you know, how do we educate our students? Because today, robots can do experiments that took years of PhD students a few years ago, can be done today by robots. Okay, so what do we do about this? How do we educate the youth? You know, do we tell them to learn ever more papers? Do we tell them to do stuff that, you know, robots can do? How do we handle this? So those are part of the chances and challenges of the higher education. We have to increase quantity and quality simultaneously. That's what the previous speakers were highlighting. Okay? We have to motivate the new generation despite growing disinterest for science education in many parts of the world. They have to learn how to learn and update and co-construct relevant knowledge. And, you know, they have to learn to cooperate, to communicate, to be creative, to be critical thinkers. And in France, you know, when we say critical, we mean, you know, negative criticisms. What I mean here is positive criticisms. How do you go from something and improve it rather than, you know, just destroy it? So we have to invent new technologies of information and communications, but also of these other Cs, the cooperation, creativity, and critical thinking. And we have to allow all these learners to develop their potential. So in the coming 10 years, there'll be 100 million new students, according to, you know, the fast growth we have. This means we have to have a new faculty every minute to take care of them. How do we train these faculties? Okay? How do we educate even those faculties to be creative and reinvent what it means to be a faculty today? So how do we lead to this paradigm shift? So when I was a kid, I played lots of chess. Okay? And because I'm very old, I could play with computers and defeat them. Okay? What you can see on the left top is Garry Kasparov, then world champion, the minute where he discovered that he had lost the championship against a computer. Okay? You can see he was not really happy, and all of the audience was completely stunned. Okay? And The Economist published an editorial that day saying, if your job looks like chess, get ready to change job. Okay? And I had been, you know, doing science exactly like I had been playing chess. Okay, and when I read this, you know, I started to reconsider that. And in fact, you know, my scientific education, I was selected on my ability to compute and memorize. And clearly today computers do this much better, okay? And clearly today computers could enter most of the international exams of most of the world universities. Is that what we want? Do we want robots in universities and kids, you know, in the streets? So what do we do about this, okay? So Garry Kasparov, that is a very clever man, has developed some interesting twist to this situation, okay? So he played against the rest of the world, okay? That's what you can see, and he wrote a book to describe this, okay? And in fact, he described that this was the hardest game he ever played, okay? And, you know, a few years before, Karpov, the then champion, played against the rest of the world and won very easily. What happened in between is that the world got more organized. Instead of, you know, voting randomly and, you know, bringing collective stupidity to propose wrong moves and so on, they played collectively and voting on one another proposition. And a 15-year-old grandmaster from the US was coordinating this, okay? And she was the one taking the lead, okay? But she was coordinating hundreds of thousands of people, intelligence, and bringing the collective intelligence to, you know, challenge Kasparov like no one had done before. The next thing that happened in the left corner here is that there was organizations of competitions where humans could play with computers against computers or against humans, okay? And the best computer then was defeated, you know, by a combination of human and computer. And the best grandmaster were defeated by the combination of human and computer, okay? And it was not the best player. It was not the best computer that won. It was the best combination of man and machine, okay? So that's where I think is an interesting paradigm for the future. We have to train our kids to ideally use the computers and develop their collective intelligence in order to face those challenges. So basically what we're saying is that we need some new creative education that is different from, you know, the formatting that, you know, I think many of us have been suffering from. And then it's very difficult because we've been educated in one format and then we can hardly think of another format, okay? So that's a big challenge, and, you know, every day that's a challenge that we have to fight against. But there is some hope, okay? Because the new generation is coming. This is the paper by the youngest authors of scientific publications ever. So can you imagine what's the age of the youngest? You know, tell me numbers, short numbers. 15. Who says? 9. Someone else? 6. So here you have the last author is my age. Okay. All of the other co-authors on that paper are 8 to 10. Okay. And I mean, I encourage you to read that paper, okay? It's a fantastic paper. In the right-hand side here, you have the principal finding, okay? So you have their scientific principal finding and another one, and they say, we also discovered that science is cool and fun because you get to do stuff that no one has ever done before, okay? So I don't know what these kids are gonna do later, but you know, I think this is very promising for the future of the world. And interestingly, you can do this even on large scales, okay? And this is a scientific paper that was in cover of Nature last year, the day of my birthday, so that was my personal present. And it's about people power, because this is a paper where gamers, through the internet, 250,000 gamers had been cooperating and solved problems that scientists could not solve before. Okay, and in September this year, they published one more such paper, okay, and it's about an AIDS puzzle that they could solve in 2 weeks, whereas it had baffled scientists for a decade. Okay, so that's so much for collective intelligence, you know, the Kasparov versus the world paradigm. So the challenge is, how can we have not one such game, but thousands of such games, so that everyone interested in any type of science could find something that motivates him or her? Okay. So what we would like to propose to, you know, everyone in the audience and beyond is a global student contest to produce more such games, to make this learning through research affordable to everyone anywhere on the planet. And that's, you know, what we could then call a global innovative learning ecosystem. This is a 19th century learning ecosystem. You can see on the right-hand side a professor that is teaching to the oldest kids. Okay, and then the best of these oldest kids are teaching the younger ones and younger ones and younger ones and younger ones. Okay, so that's one way to face these challenges of how to train new faculty every day. You train people that train people that train people, and they transfer knowledge. And if you manage to focus their attention in clever ways, such as it was done in these scientific games, then you can really develop these new learning ecosystems. And you can allow them to meet physically in nice places, in scientific clubs throughout the planet. So basically the point I want to raise is, how do we favor the births and diffusions of more such innovations? Okay, I think we have to train innovators and allowing them to learn through research as much as possible. Okay. So for instance, the students I train in Paris, when I told them about what the kids in Hungary were doing, they instantly created an outreach program for kids in French suburbs. Okay, and so, you know, my PhD students are training my master's students, that are training my undergrad students, that are training these high school kids, that are, you know, offering new ways of learning about science through science festival to primary school age. Okay, so that's the type of leverage effect you can get. Okay, and you can create incubators or pre-incubator for innovations, where people that want to innovate but don't know yet how to and what about innovation they should push forward, you can bring them together and help them to do these things. Okay? Then you have to evaluate these innovations. And very much like in biomedical research, which is the topics I'm tackling now, you have to have phase 1, 2, and 3, where you progressively increase the numbers of people that can have access to the most successful progress. And so you have to identify and diffuse these best innovations. And I think, you know, especially in a forum like this, we have to think about what are the best innovations in each one of our country, and then what can we do to export the best things that we've done at home to others and import what's the best things that have been happening elsewhere. Okay, and that's why I think this forum is really nice. And for me, it will be even nicer, honestly, if there were younger people presenting the new ways that they are learning through research these days. So I think we have to encourage and protect creative minds. You know, I was faced with this exact type of quote, and I'm sure many of you have been, because you're all innovators, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Okay, and that's a real problem. Okay, they keep telling you, no, it's impossible, it's never been done. Okay, but if it's been done somewhere else by, you know, some great scientist, then maybe we should import it. Okay, so that's, you know, we have to encourage and protect these creative minds and give them the right to fail as well. Okay? Because if you are not failing, then you cannot innovate. Okay? Einstein himself said this. Okay? My own PhD was about the evolution of mutation rate. And if bacteria did not mutate enough, then they could not evolve. Okay? That's the lessons that we can take from science. So another lesson we can take this time from primates is this young female macaque on the left. Okay? This young female deserved a Nobel Prize for macaques. Okay? Because on a Japanese beach, she was first fed potatoes with all of her tribe, but the potatoes were mixing with sand on the beach, and she first discovered how to wash the potatoes and eat them. Okay, but then they were fed rice. Okay, and then again the rice was mixed by the alpha males fighting with the sand. Okay, and then she invented a way of separating the sand from the rice with the technologies available on the beach. Okay, so I don't know how many of you would deserve this Nobel Prize. We can discuss it over dinner if you want. Okay, but some of the interesting part of this story is that then she was imitated by others. Okay, so innovation can spread, but who imitated her first? Her young female peers. Okay, and then the young males. And who were the last one to imitate her? The alpha males. Okay, so if, you know, this is applied obviously only to this tribe of primates. If you know other primates that behave like this, let me know. Okay. Another example I wanted to share with you, because for me it was a haha moment when I learned about this. This is a picture that describes one of the greatest discovery in mankind, which is that you have to wash hands. Okay. In order to, before to give birth, you have to wash hands. Okay, and the doctors that were coming from autopsy room straight into delivery room were not doing this. And the first guy that said this, they didn't want to believe him. Okay? And in fact, they drove him nuts, and he ended up, you know, he's Semmelweis. So this is exactly here these things happen. Okay? And Semmelweis was driven nuts. Okay? And he was not believed. And it's only because of Lister and Pasteur that then people have implemented what he was saying. Okay? So the question is, why such an obvious innovation did not spread? Okay? Because when he was telling to people, if you wash your hands, you're going to save life, my understanding of this is that they were hearing for decades, we have not been washing hands, therefore we've been killing people. And they could not hear that message. Okay? Actually, the only one that believed him committed suicide. Okay? And so this is, you know, a real problem about innovations. You know, conservatism has a strong psychology that is incarnated in this Semmelweis example. Okay? So you have to tell people the world is different today. It was fine to do whatever you were doing in the past, but in the 21st century, if we want to face the challenge we have to face collectively, we have to do things differently. So those are a list of questions that I want to leave you with, and we can, you know, discuss individually or collectively through the web, through Twitter, or through dinner. But you know, basically, my first question, and maybe most important one, would be for the subject of today is, what is found in a good campus and is not yet available through the web? Okay, MIT put all of their open courseware, so the course content is there. But still, if you give the chance to any student to go to MIT, they will fly there. Okay? So what can we do to reduce the gap between the real MIT and whatever is available on the web? Okay? That's the first question. Another question, which is, I think, very important, is that we were all raised in, and our ancestors were raised in a world where information was limited and was limiting for knowledge and development and creativity. Today is just the opposite. There is oceans of information, some of them of very low quality and some of them of good or top quality. Okay? How do we help students to navigate those uneven waters? Another one is about Socratic technologies. So what I will call Socratic technologies, I don't know if you reread recently Socrates, but Socrates was against the technologies available in his time. Okay? And there were two technologies at the time. They were painting and writing. I didn't like any of the two. Okay? Why? Because the one person that was producing that, you know, painting or writing did not know who would be the final receiver. And he said this was not good for him. Okay? And he was also against this because the one person reading the text could not ask questions, and the famous Socratic questioning could not happen. Okay? So I think, you know, Socrates would be against television today. The question is, would he be more in favor of other technologies such as blog or Twitter or something? And can we invent technologies that would be even more Socratic than those? And then there is a poem from T.S. Eliot that says, where is the wisdom we've lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we've lost in information? And then we can add, where is the information we've lost in data? Okay. So if we don't teach the kids to go from the data to the information to the knowledge to the wisdom, then I think that our planet is going to have some problems. Okay. So how do we do this? Okay. How do we find ideas made? If you're an innovator, you're very likely to be surrounded by people that are not as innovative as you are. Okay. So how do you find someone that shares the same will to innovate in the same direction? How do you find ideas made so that together you can grow those ideas and transform them into innovations that can benefit the world? How can we create frames of freedom and creativity? You know, I visited the Finnish system, which is apparently one of the very best systems in the world. That's what they do. They create frames of freedom and creativity for their kids. How do we create these new technologies to train and construct and to train the new co-constructors of knowledge that can work together to build this new knowledge? How do we teach how to learn anywhere and anytime? Because, you know, today we are, I mean, we've all learned something in universities, but we've certainly learned more outside of universities, okay? And that's because we received a decent education that allows us to build and be, you know, autodidact from then on, okay? But how do we allow more people to do this, okay? So those are the challenges that I would like to discuss with you, and I think my time is running out. So thank you very much for your attention.